Hello, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another thing where I talk about things. Today we're going to talk about the character Lowry and where exactly he comes from. So this character is based on a friend of mine that I had in high school, and in fact a lot of the characters in the We Will Not Play D&D things are based on those particular friends, but they're also influenced by what the players do during the game, so it's kind of a mix of different people. But when I was thinking of the personality for Lowry, what I was primarily thinking of was a friend of mine who was, I guess, one of the weirder guys in my group of friends. He was always kind of a little disaffected and sort of rebellious, and he actually didn't get to play with us as often as some of the other guys did. Unfortunately, he had a job. He worked at, like, the local McDonald's or something like that, and so his hours were really weird, and he could never predict when exactly he was going to have free time, so he would try to catch games when he could, but he would just come and go. So his thing was that he would always make a really weird character with really bizarre skills, or just skills that were very targeted towards one particular thing, and he would show up when he could, behave in whatever way that made sense at the time, and then vanish. And so, for example, like, one game he showed up, and he had a character who was based on, I can't remember the name, there's like a character from Saturday Night Live, I think it was like Mr. Jingles, where they had someone dress up in overalls and pretend to be like a monkey. And so he was playing basically that. He was like, the character looks a lot like that guy, but he's like psychic, and he can mind control people. And so I remember him playing that character, and he didn't really do a whole lot, except for his mind control powers weren't that well-tuned. So it was kind of like he would grab someone, and then he could give them an order, and they would try to do it to the best of their ability, but he would usually give them impossible orders, because it was like he would just be like, go do this, like, go, you know, conquer the planet for me, and then that person would try their hardest to do the request, but it would just be impossible to be out of there. Like, I remember at one point, like, we got trapped in the sewers, and we were trying to open a manhole, and none of us were strong enough to get it open, and so it was, like, over a busy highway or something. Well, there's no manholes on the highway, but it was, like, over a busy street, and he was able to, like, mentally find someone in the crowd up above, like, walking along, and he was like, open the manhole, and so the person just, like, walked out in the street and got hit by a car. And then he was like, dang it, well, traffic's probably stopped now. He grabbed, like, another person. I was like, okay, you open the manhole. You know, we all got out that way. So, he was also the guy who joined in with the Children of the Sandler thing, and he was the one who played Grover Cleveland, or whatever, if you're familiar with that whole story. It was the guy who kept trying to show up to play a game, and he made a character that Sandler really liked, the GM really liked. And so he would play for a little while, and then he'd have to leave early to go to work or for some other obligation. And then Sandler would play his character, and then Sandler, because he liked the character, would play the character as being more powerful than he was. And he would, like, pick fights that he couldn't win, and the character would die. And then this friend would come back, and he'd be mad, and he, like, Sandler would be like, oh, your character's dead, you have to make another character. And he'd be like, okay. And he would just erase the name of the character and write in the name of a different U.S. president. And that was just the kind of guy he was. That was really normal for him. And of course, in that case, we couldn't blame him because it wasn't really his fault. You know, he went through all the trouble to make this character. He cared about it. He didn't want to make a new one. So as far as he was concerned, Grover Cleveland's identical twin, you know, Howard Taft or whatever, that's just as good. So yes, the other thing that I remember distinctly about him was he was also really into strange film and stuff like that. So he was the reason that I watched Naked Lunch as a teenager. I had no idea what that was until he brought it up, and he was like, look guys, I've got a film and it's going to horrify you. And, I don't know what all we expected, but we all watched it, and we all agreed that was probably one of the grosser films that we'd ever seen. In particular, like, we all had parts of that movie that we liked the least, I think. I feel like one of the ones I really disliked when they rubbed the powder on the bug's anus. That was pretty gross, and I think my friend was like, I don't know what it was about the typewriter coming to life and humping that lady, but that was pretty good. Oh, no, I think I also really liked the one where I really disliked the scene where the there's like a millipede that crushes a man's head while having sex. Naked Lunch is kind of a crazy film. Anyway, though, he had that, and he had, like, a bunch of other films that he wanted to watch. But I think after Naked Lunch, we were a little bit less willing to let this guy choose movie night. More often, like we had a friend who had the entire Red Dwarf collection. So more often when we did, like, I don't know, movie day, we would just watch something from the Red Dwarf collection or, you know, some movie that we all would like. But when he got to choose, we had to watch something weird. So, yeah, you know, in hindsight, it was just like he brought things into our lives that we would not have seen otherwise. And it wasn't really like malicious. It was just he had strange tastes. And I don't know how he found these things back in that time. I mean, the internet wasn't as big as it is today. So it was harder. It was still harder back then to find that type of thing if you didn't know where to look for it. So, yeah, I'm trying to think. I guess the last thing that I can really say about him is I realized when I said I was going to talk about the guy that Lowry was based on that actually I don't have that many amazing stories about him. All in all, I mean, he was a good guy and everything like that. But when I realized, I was like, oh man, he really did kind of show up pretty sporadically, didn't he? But the last thing that he actually was a year ahead of us in high school. And so the last that I really heard of him, he was experimenting with a lot of drugs and alcohol in high school. And, like, I still could talk to him on social media, I guess. He's one of the few people who hasn't, like, I don't know. A lot of people are kind of going silent. They're privating their stuff. I think everyone's just sick of the politics and everything like that. But he never got sour on it to the extent that he shut things out. So I think I still have him on Facebook. I just never talk to him anymore because, I don't know. He went his own way. He got into his own stuff. He got into some weird movements and... yeah, that's life. I mean, for me, it was like practically half a lifetime ago now. I'm getting that old that some of these stories are from that far back. But, yeah, there it is. A whole 7-minute story. So I guess the other thing that I'm going to do is I was thinking about Steve Boy Hot Dog today, and I thought to myself, I'd kind of like to talk about what Steve Boy Hot Dog was really going to be about, because I kept promising that Steve Boy Hot Dog was going to go somewhere. And then I kind of quit doing it before anyone really saw where it was going. And in a nutshell, the entire thing was supposed to be told through the lens of Steve, which was intentionally inscrutable. And the problem with that was I had two problems. The first is that I'd never really written a comic before. Well, I'd written Lord of the Dwarves, I think, and a couple of other things, but I didn't really have much experience writing a comic. And so the pacing and the dialogue and everything, it was all kind of new to me. And I didn't know how to get that story out there. So then I got in this weird format, which is like not even a standard format of like, okay, you have this inscrutable character and everything's really unclear to the viewer. And I jumped into that without having much ground beneath me on how to write comics in the first place. And it was a poor choice as far as something that should have gone on for as long as I wanted it to. But the idea was that Steve being somewhat inscrutable was kind of important because there was supposed to be a certain amount of mystery around the entire thing, which you wouldn't be let in on, partly because Steve was inscrutable. The idea was that he was strange and weird, and he would start to like the superhero angle of what he was doing, which was he's going out and he's fighting these creatures and then defeating them, and that's super, and he's having a fun time, and so he doesn't question it very much. And people keep trying to explain to him the deeper meanings, but he's too weird, and they can only selectively get through to him. What was actually going on behind the scenes with all that was, I did the whole comic where there was Lemuria, and this was something that I put together not actually realizing that there's apparently a dedicated conspiracy-like movement around the idea of Lemuria. Lemuria is an old idea. It's back when they were kind of looking at the world and its geology, they were trying to figure out how everything all connected, and they noticed that it looked like everything could have sort of fit together at one point. So there was this theory that maybe there was a continent that for whatever reason sank below the ocean called Mu, or Lemuria, and that was how everything all fit together. Now, over the years, they were able to figure out that, you know, that didn't really make a lot of sense. The continents drifted, and that's why they were all separated, and so they abandoned the theory of Mu. But it remained in literature, it still existed out there. And I guess nowadays, the internet being what it is, there's people out there who really believe that Mu existed, and they will fight you tooth and nail over the existence of Mu. So, I didn't know this when I wrote this, but I just took the idea of like, okay, so there was once a continent called Mu, and it was actually supposed to be a living creature, is what it was. They were like actually living on the back of a giant, like, beast of some sort. And this beast was magical. So the people who were living on the beast then kind of absorbed some of the magical radiation of this creature, and they had their own little society. And the magic made them strong, and they were also quite independent. And it was like a small tribe. So they really weren't all that amazing. They were kind of independent, and they didn't really work together very much. The king of Lemuria was supposed to be like a nominal thing. No one really respected it that much. And then there was one guy who was like an oracle. He could see the future, and he was like predicting disaster for everybody, but couldn't really get anyone to pay attention to it. And so then one day, the creature woke up, and then like rolled over and then sank below the ocean a little further, and that was it. Mu was gone. So supposedly somewhere in like the bottom of the ocean, there's like a creature, but you would have to like, there's a certain amount of its back is just like earth, and so you wouldn't really know it just by looking. You'd have to like drill down and find the actual fleshy bits, and that was kind of where the Lemurians and the superpowers came from. And then the Lemurians were having kids, but as they bred with other people, the magic would kind of wear down, and as they got older, although the Lemurians could live forever, their DNA, their reproductive DNA would start to get messy. And so as they got older, if they had kids, the kids would be these weird, like, mutant abominations that weren't really like people at all. And so later on, I was going to have kind of a horror element where they were going to find somebody, like one of these kids that had been had later on in life. And the trick was that Steeb was actually one of these sort of aberrations, but by sheer luck, he wound up pretty human, and so I was always going to leave it as a mystery as to whether or not he was, like, attached to the hot dog suit. But some of his, like, weird mental quirks, and the thing with the hot dog suit, it was related to the fact that he wasn't really totally human. He was actually kind of a bizarre mutant offspring of a very old Lemurian who was just irresponsibly, like, meeting women and then falling in love and doing all this stuff. And it turned out that all the creatures, like, the living animals and, like, the nachos and things like that, these were all created by his father, who originally represented the entire Lemurian military because he could just give life to inanimate objects, and those inanimate objects would just naturally like him off the bat. And so he'd say, like, you know, defend me. And they'd be like, all right, bud, you know, we're friends. So, yeah, his dad was just kind of this sort of, like, whimsical, irresponsible dude. And it was eventually going to come to light that Steve's father was the one who was making these creatures that he was fighting. And there was going to be another element where the creatures were, they lose control when they get emotional, and then they kind of have to beeline on that one emotion for a while, so if they get really angry, then they get really angry, and they'll just, like, fight tooth and nail for a while. But if you could, like, subdue them and calm them down, then they'd be fine. And so there was going to be some elements that I had in mind. I don't really like it when things get too black and white, and so I kind of wanted to do some stuff with, like, okay, so these animal people are discriminated against in some ways, but at the same time, there's varying demeanors among them. Like, some of them fly off the handle a little bit easier than others. There was going to be a character called Wealthy Walrus, who was very rich because he'd been around for a long time, and he'd accumulated a good amount of wealth, and was running advertising campaigns and things like that. And some people really liked him, and some people really hated Wealthy Walrus. And I had like notes on all this stuff, but it was going to be kind of like the discrimination was justified in some ways, but then, like, the ultra-violent response that Steve was giving them, or the stupid combative response that Steve was giving them wasn't strictly appropriate. So, yeah, that, like, I was kind of going, like, I had this idea for this nuance and this interesting stuff, which if I were to just say it out loud, would probably have been better than the Inscrutable Adventures of Steve Boy Hot Dog that we got. But that's where I was going for that. And ultimately what was going to happen was it turned out that the girl, the blonde girl, Linda, she was the princess of the Lemurians because she was like a distant descendant of the king of Lemuria, who was actually still alive and was really kind of a rotten person. The guy was sort of, over the years, he was really bitter about his, you know, his race and the way things used to be, and, you know, like, I should be in charge. But he was kind of, I don't know, he was kind of a hack, was the idea. And so, like, Linda really looked up to all this stuff. She really believed in all the stories about the Lemurians and why they were so great and everything like that. And Lena came from, like, a long line of, like, shield bearers for the Lemurians. And she had also been told a lot of stuff, but her family wasn't quite as intense about it as Linda's was, so she didn't really like it all that much. And, you know, she was kind of gravitate towards Steve because Steve was, like, an anomaly in the whole thing. And so it really kind of shook up her whole world. And that was why Linda hated him so much, was because he was shaking up her entire world. And like I say, it all made sense in my notes, and it was all there in my head. It just certainly did not come out in the writing. It might have had I kept on going long enough, but I do think it's a lot to ask to be like, yeah, if you just get through the first, 100 pages, it starts to pick up. I mean, what is it? What is this, a Final Fantasy game? Modern Final Fantasy? Yeah. So Steve, that was going to be Steve Boy Hot Dog. The grand finale was going to be that they were going to try to take over the city, and then Steve was going to, like, fight them. And I think I was going to have the Oracle was actually the guy in the basement that owned the Oracle Mall, and he, like, lived in the center of the labyrinth. And so that was what that was. It was going to be, like, Lena was going to be talking about the Oracle from time to time, and, like, oh, if only we could talk to the Oracle. And it was going to turn out that the guy that lived in Oracle Mall was the Oracle. And he was just... I don't know. So there was that, and one other thing I was going to do is I was going to have, whenever I felt like I was comfortable drawing people enough that I could say, like, oh, these actually look like attractive, like, passable people, the faces look right, the bodies look right, and everything, I was going to do not a beach episode, but like a swimming pool episode. They were going to go to a water park, and Steve was going to be all like, oh boy, ladies in swimsuits, because he's a teenager, you know. And then I was going to have the girl show up, and it was going to be like Linda was going to wear like a really sporty looking, you know, like shorts and this type of thing. Like nothing too like provocative, it's a great sportwear. And then like, Lena was going to be incredibly self-conscious, and she was basically going to be wearing like shorts and a baggy shirt the entire time and never take it off. And then Steve would be in the hot dog, and then I was going to draw like a lot of fat people and like old people and all kinds of like not so attractive body shapes and things like that, because they were, you know, it's like a tourist location. And so that was kind of that was one of my other long-term goals, was to get really good at people and then draw ugly people. That was something I wanted to do. I would do like a certain amount of, I don't know, like nude-ish men, or like men that were scantily clad, and a good several of those comics, because one of the things I was trying to do was trying to figure out anatomy and just being like, how should this look? How does this look? How do I get the, like, where are the muscles? And so, like, it's just one of those things where it's like, all right, so if I need the muscles to be clear to me, like, I'll just make them really well-defined, the guy will be in a Speedo. So there was definitely tons of elements of art practice in Steve. And since... I haven't done Steve in a while, but since walking away from it, I still do drawing practice on my own. I don't know, I've improved since the last Steve comic. I feel like I've gotten faces figured out a little bit better and everything like that. But art has been an uphill struggle for me for a long while. It takes many, many years to get very good. And it's hard to do if you put yourself on a deadline. You say, like, I gotta try to do this every so-and-so. Because then you're encouraged to rush and just accept things as bad, and you don't have as much time to really study what you've done wrong. It's harder. You know, repetition is good, but careful study is also important. So, short one today, I guess. I don't have a lot to say. Larry and Steve. That's what this thing is about. So I hope you guys are having a great week, and I will catch you all next time.